From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Well, nerds, this one is for you. Today's show is a doubleheader of deep nerddom, and I say this with pride. First up, we talk to a flavor scientist. My life is driven by flavor. I wouldn't have the intense curiosity I do about food unless the seductress, that is flavor, led me into the larger rabbit hole of food studies. When you're in the restaurant business, flavor is power, and it needs to hit in the first few bites of food. But what exactly is it, and how is it created in your own head? We've been following the interests of Ariel Johnson for a decade. She's perhaps most famous for her work with Rene Redzepi and Noma, where she co-founded the restaurant's fermentation lab. And more recently, she served as science officer on Elton Brown's television show, Good Eats. Her new book, Flavorama, is a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor. Hi, Ariel. It is amazing to have you here in studio with me.
It is amazing to be here in studio with you. So thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here. Okay, so when I hear the word flavor scientist, my mind goes to the industrialized food world. Mm-hmm. Someone working for a big company like Kraft or Kellogg, who's trying to create the next viral snack food trend. But that is not what you do. So how does your work differ from most other flavor scientists who are working today?
So yeah, most food scientists and most flavor scientists are employed by large food companies, largely because that is who there is to hire people like that and pay for the field to exist. I'm kind of at a little bit of a right angle to what they do. So, you know, it intersects in the chemistry and in the sensory science, but I'm much more interested in understanding flavor as an everyday experience, as a expression of biology and culture and ecology and something to use in the kitchen. So I do apply it, but in a kind of different way than it is typically applied.
Are you often contacted by chefs who are trying to create something or push something farther and they need science to help them take a leap?
Yeah, often they don't necessarily know what science they need, but they know that I am good at solving problems. Using science. So I do get a lot of questions that often a chef has been working in one direction or another, maybe trying to do a fermentation project or, you know, get a flavored ice to behave a certain way. And I, when I can, which is a lot of the time actually, like to step in and try to cherry pick what area is it, biology, is it chemistry, is it molecules reacting, is it, you know, volatility or something like that, and set them on the right path to get what they want.
That must be eminently satisfying.
Incredibly. That's my favorite thing.
What intrigues me about flavor is how personal it can be. You know, I sat across from noted restaurant critic Jonathan Gold for a couple of decades each week, listening to him describe flavor. And I would always ask myself, is that how I perceive what he's talking about? And often in my own mind, it was, no, I'm perceiving it differently. But how interesting it is what he is perceiving. Could you speak a little bit about that, the personal nature of flavor?
Yeah, so one of the things I find most exciting and attractive about flavor is that it sits at this intersection of the extremely concrete. It's based on molecules, which we can measure, you know, real matter, and the personal. So, you know, flavor doesn't happen until you put something in your mouth and the signals get sent to your brain. And then, you know, from there, kind of all bets are off. But one important piece to this, the connection between flavor and the personal, is that flavor is not just taste, it is also smell. Smell is a huge, huge essential part of flavor. And smell, more than any of our other senses, is deeply tied, really in a physical, neurological way, to our emotions and memories. Once we gather smell molecules and build a smell signal and kind of pass it to the rest of the brain, the first place that it goes is the limbic system and places like the amygdala, places where we keep our most emotional, personal memories and associations. So with smell, and therefore with flavor, we'll often have our personal history, our emotional reaction to it, come up before we even can recognize or articulate what it is that we are smelling and tasting.
So let's get into the science. What is flavor?
Flavor is a composite sense, combining mostly taste and smell, as well as some, you know, information from all the other senses, but taste and smell are the two big ones.
And so taste, meaning sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami,
yes,
is something a lot of people know about, but let's focus on smell. In the book, you say, right now as you read this, you have brain cells dangling out of the bottom of your skull, exposed to the air inside your nose at all times, and we all walk around like this is totally normal.
Yeah, I mean, like, I know that is how it works. I know it's a real thing, and still, like, every time I think about it, it blows my mind that that is how smell works. So, yeah, we have neurons that are attached on one end to a structure called the olfactory bulb in our brain, and then those neurons, those brain cells, pass through a small holes in the base of our skull and just kind of hang out, waiting to grab onto smell molecules on the in the inside of our nasal cavity.
Amazing, amazing. You compare smell to a QR code. What do you mean by that?
So it's probably best understood by comparing it to taste. With taste, we have very distinct matches between specific molecules, specific receptors, and specific perceptions. When you taste something sour, acid molecules will go onto your tongue. They will interact with the sour receptor, which pretty much only interacts with them and with nothing else. And the signal that gets sent to your brain is like pressing a key on a piano. So sour, loud and clear, very, very simple, very one-directional. With smell, we don't have a finite set of smells the way we do with tastes. We have, you know, the five basic tastes. With smell, we have about 400 different types of receptors. And the way that we collect smell information is that rather than having these one-to-one pairings like acid to sour receptor and sugar to sweet receptor, all volatile smell molecules can interact with like several of these different 400 different receptors, and any receptor might grab onto, you know, a few or dozens of molecules in a different way.
So let's get into specific ingredients. What is meat?
Meat, from the perception of a flavor scientist, is a mostly flavorless but texturally interesting sponge of proteins soaked full of water with a relatively tiny amount of flavor-active molecules in it.
And then the meaty, those flavor molecules are like precursors, and they create meaty flavor once that meat is cooked.
Yeah, so if you know, smell ground beef or taste beef tartare from a, you know, restaurant or a supplier that is reputable enough to give you raw meat, you know, you'll notice it doesn't taste like beefy, like beef stew necessarily, or cooked meat. So that beefy flavor really doesn't exist until you start heating up the meat, and different ions and enzymes and things like that interact with things like cell membrane lipids and free amino acids and stuff like that. Stuff that's floating around. And once all these components meet and get shaken up in the heat, they'll make these very beefy flavored molecules. That is the flavor of meat that we know and love.
Okay, spice.
Well, spice.
We're here in LA, right? Why do different versions of chilies hit differently?
In terms of spiciness, chilies have a very, very spicy molecule in them called capsaicin. The range of spicy in chilies is pretty much a one-to-one correspondence with the concentration of this molecule capsaicin that they make. The kind of weird and fun thing about spicy is that it feels like a taste, but it is not actually a taste because we do not sense it with our taste buds. We sense it with a pain receptor. So technically, spicy is a part of touch.
Wow, I love that. So for some unknown reason, I have about 2 pounds of cocoa nibs in my pantry.
Nice. It's a good problem to have.
You gave me the gift in your book of cocoa nib lemon butter.
Yes.
So how do we make it and what do we do with it?
So cocoa nib lemon butter is a compound butter. It's a recipe I wrote to kind of highlight and showcase how good fat is as a carrier of aromas specifically. You know, any compound butter is really about taking some kind of flavorful solid ingredient and folding it together with butter and letting it hang out for a little while. With cocoa nib and lemon butter, you get these deep roasted fruity notes from the cocoa nibs, some bitterness, and also this very light, sprightly, heady citrus flavor from lemon zest. And the nice thing about compound butter is, well, it's easy to make, and by, you know, giving these aromatic, flavorful ingredients a chance to hang out with the butter for a little while, you'll get something that is kind of infused with the character of the flavors, but also has these kind of intense pops of it. So it's a dynamic eating experience that I really like.
It's really interesting because, I mean, the reason I have so many cocoa nibs is that I really love making biscotti with cocoa nibs. And so I think I'm going to make that butter and then use the butter in the recipe.
That sounds delicious.
You.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's like exactly the kind of thinking I hope people take away from reading about flavor, is that basically anytime you're cooking and bringing ingredients together, you have an opportunity to bring them together in a more flavorful, more delicious way.
Tell me about your peanut Russian.
It's my take on a white Russian, which of course is coffee liqueur and half and half. I don't know if people still drink them regularly. I like them a lot. Basically, this idea of an alcoholic beverage that's got this kind of like deep coffee, bitter brownness, and a lot of creaminess. But in this case, instead of a dairy product, you use peanut milk, which is basically like making soy milk, but with peanuts instead of soybeans. So it's extracting all of the flavor of the peanut into this like creamy quote-unquote milk, and then using a coffee-infused rum in the place of a Kahlua to make a, you know, really creamy, nutty, also vegan cocktail experience.
Sounds so good to me. Why are you a fond evangelist? Someone who goes so far as to cook giant trays of chicken that you're then going to dispose of because you have stabbed it so many times to let the juices flow out and caramelize on the pan.
So the fond is, you know, as you say, when you're cooking a piece of meat and the juices leak out, basically they make this brown layer that sticks to the pan. And this is, to me, the perfect concentrated essence of meatiness. So whenever I brown a piece of meat or I'm trying to make gravy or roasting a piece of meat, I always, always, always deglaze the pan and find a way to incorporate the fond, the, you know, browned meaty parts into either the meat itself or into a sauce. So at previous Thanksgivings when we've grilled our turkey and we're not roasting it in a pan, so did not have a fond. I did not want terrible gravy. I think fond is essential for good gravy. So we roasted sheet pans of chicken drumsticks that I stabbed all over while they were cooking, which you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to, you know, stick your knife too many times into a piece of meat to check because it'll let the juices run out. But in this case, I wanted the juices to run out because I wanted them to kind of collect on the pan and make a extra, extra large fond to use wherever I wanted, in this case, delicious gravy.
Such a great idea.
In my defense, I didn't actually throw the drumsticks away. I did use them to make a light stock. But in this case, you're really, you know, taking that flavorless sponge and separating it from the meat juice, which you get to experience then as its own, like, concentrated essence.
Does texture have anything to do with flavor? Is it just a bonus?
No, texture is a huge part of flavor. You know, the texture of salt grains, for example, can have a really significant impact on how salty you perceive a salt to be. Things like astringency in red wine. So if you, you know, drink a young red wine and it kind of makes the inside of your mouth feel like sandpaper, you'll have a bit of a different flavor experience overall than if you were just drinking it without tannin.
And is that because the tannins are actually having a physical effect on the surface of your tongue?
Yeah, so actually not on the surface of your tongue. Your entire mouth is lubricated with saliva. Sorry for saying lubricated and saliva. I know those are gross words. Lubricated with saliva. And what makes saliva a good lubricant in this case is because it has different types of proteins, sometimes what are called glycoproteins, floating around in it. tannins, which are groupings of polyphenols that make red wine red and other, you know, fruits and flowers the colors that they are, actually react with the proteins and pull them out of solution. So it'll actually make your saliva a much less efficient lubricant. Basically, astringency is the unmediated feeling of your tongue touching the inside of your mouth. It's
I love that. I love that. Oh God, this is such a nerd fest. It's just the greatest thing ever. Do you think that one reason why a lot of good restaurant food happens is because chefs take advantage of opportunities to create layered flavor? They take the time to do that, whereas at home we just want to feed ourselves?
Absolutely. You know, in a restaurant, since you are doing all of your prep in advance and then executing many dishes over the course of a night, the structure is really set up that allows you to pre-make or pre-prep a lot of different components and then bring them together on the final plate. So I'd say, yeah, the biggest difference between really complex tasting restaurant food and home cooking is this sort of singular focus on making each component as flavorful as possible, often regardless of how inefficient and time consuming that is.
Yeah. So this is where all of the infusions, extractions, dehydrated situations come into
fermentation,
play.
Fermentation, things like that. Yeah, if you want to, you know, start your prep months before you're going to eat a dish.
Like at Noma.
Exactly.
Okay, we have to talk about pie because, you know that we're kind of pie obsessed.
I love pie.
And specifically apple pie, we have a big contest coming up in a few weeks, and there are two apple categories this year. How is the flavor of an apple transformed by heat?
So when you heat up smell molecules, since those molecules are volatile, they, you know, are able to basically spend time as a gas and float through the air. Once you heat them up, they will start to essentially boil off and dissipate. So, you know, this is how like a reed diffuser or one of those like candle rings that you put essential oils into work. You heat up smell molecules and they'll go up into the air more. They won't all do it at the same, you know, rate and to the same degree. So when you cook apples, heat up pieces of fruit, but specifically apples, you'll tend to boil off some of the kind of lighter, tutti-frutti and green top notes. And what you're left with are a lot of, you know, what a perfumer might call the base notes, the physically and chemically heavier smell molecules that, in the case of apples, have this really decadent, plush, you know, rose petal, cooked fruit, caramel, tobacco character. That's, you know, one of my favorite flavors.
Oh my God. They're called the greatest description.
My favorite apple molecule is called beta damascenone, and it is a norisoprenoid. It's one of these apple base notes.
Do you have any advice on how to enhance the flavor of an apple pie?
Yes. One is to enhance the flavor of the apples themselves by trying to induce chemical reactions that will create more flavors than the apples already have. So if you were to roast or caramelize the apples a little bit, or if not all of the apples, some of the apples beforehand, you'll be introducing more flavor molecules into the pie, literally. If you include any fats or butter in the cream in the filling itself, let the apples and the spices mingle together with any fat, you know, for maybe a day in the fridge before you put them all together, and you'll get this much more permeated, infused flavor expression of all of those things. If you wanted to go crazy, you could enhance the apple flavor of the apple filling by using a bit of apple molasses, which is really just reduced apple juice or apple cider. So if you juice some of the apples and simmer it very gently until you make a syrup, you'll get essentially super concentrated essence of apple that you can then really beef up the apple pie with.
That's what I do.
Nice. Oh, great. Great minds think alike, I guess.
Yeah, there are a couple apple farms that make an exceptional like cider extract.
Yeah, boiled cider.
Boiled
delicious.
Cider. It's so delicious.
Well, and I think that's a, you know, a great example of thinking about the science of flavor doesn't have to feel like a, you know, organic chemistry class. It can be just a little enhancement to your existing culinary intuition. So I'm glad you already figured that one out.
If you can exhort us to take on board one technique at home to create more flavor, what would it be?
I think one of the easiest ways to embrace this is to embrace the Maillard reaction. The Maillard reaction is a reaction between amino acids, so like the building blocks of proteins, and sugars. But chemistry aside, it is the source of all of the browned, toasted, roasted flavors in things like chocolate, coffee, roasted meat, chicken skin, toast, brown butter, things like this. So it's a reaction that has many different faces. You know, chocolate doesn't taste the same as coffee, although they're both sort of brown tasting. And really the easiest way to you know, use this to add extra layers of flavor to whatever you're cooking is to heat up any ingredients that you have, whether that's butter or a piece of meat, so that these things have a chance to react with each other and to, you know, as much as possible, do things like dab the outside of meat before you sear it so that there isn't as much water, so that the water doesn't absorb all of the heat. The heat can go into the meat and then create this delicious browning reaction. So a lot of the, you know, the precursors, the building blocks for this stuff is just hanging out in the ingredients that we're using all of the time. And all you have to do is be a little bit clever about how you're applying heat to them, and you'll, you know, reap all of these flavor rewards.
Thank you so much, Ariel.
Thank you so much. This was a super fun conversation. I wish it could go longer.
That was flavor scientist Ariel Johnson. Her new book is Flavorama, a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor. Clearly, I love this book. We've got the recipe for her cocoa nib lemon butter on our website. That's at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, tap water. Have you ever pondered what it tastes like? My next guest has spent years considering just that. We dive into her fascinating research when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Imagine putting billions of dollars into the mission of creating something that tastes like nothing. When it comes to municipal water systems the world over, that's what water companies strive to provide. No bad or off flavors, no assertive minerals, just bland safety. It's a miracle, and one we shouldn't take for granted. But in The Taste of Water, author Christy Spackman invites us to look deeper at our water and ask questions about what it should and shouldn't taste like. Hi, Christy.
Hello.
Thank you for coming to the show. Your book just fed so deeply into my inner nerd.
That is such a pleasure to hear. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's turn to water, which is its own not small miracle. Your work opens up with an incident in Chicago in 1927 when demand for bottled water outstripped supply on the city's south side. What happened that day, and why was it a turning point for the city?
So as anyone who's been to Chicago knows, it's nicely situated on Lake Michigan. And Lake Michigan, at the very bottom, happens to have been and continue to be the home of a lot of industrial activity. And on that day, when residents on the south side opened up their taps, the water coming out smelled really badly, like a super strong medicinal smell. And the poor water workers didn't entirely know what was going on. They made the mistake of increasing the amount of chlorine they were putting in the water, which then further exacerbated the smell. And what it ended up being was that there had been a bunch of phenol dumped into the lake as part of the industrial processes that were happening down in the Indiana/Kalama area. And the wind just happened to blow those contaminated waters northward, even though that's not how stuff normally circulated, ended up coming in through the intake pipes, going through the plants, where the phenol then interacted with the chlorine to create the super medicinal smell. And so for residents on the south side, all they knew is they'd open their taps and things were so bad that they knew their body said, don't drink this. And, you know, the engineers in response were saying, hey, this is safe. As far as we're testing, there's no microbial action. And so it's that moment, which I think many of us have experienced in some way, where your everyday experience or expertise comes up against some sort of scientific knowledge structure that says, hey, this is okay. And you're like, I'm not so certain that I actually think this is okay.
For the most part, what does water that comes out of most municipal water systems, taps, taste like now? Is there a range of taste, or is it, as you say, a discourse of absence?
I love this question because there are two answers to it. The first answer is yes, there is a range of taste. Anyone who's traveled to, for example, Jacksonville, Florida, where my in-laws currently live now, knows that the water there has a much higher sulfur content than, say, the water in Chicago, New York City, Los Angeles, or Phoenix. Similarly, the water in Phoenix, especially in October, November, which is I'm going to call it our tasty season. It's our green, musty season. It tastes very differently than the water in Chicago at that same time of year. But what's interesting is those differences are a lot less than they used to be. One of my favorite things that is recounted from some of the public health records of the late 1800s is how folks in St. Louis were accustomed to drinking kind of a reddish brown colored water that had a high level of iron in it. Folks in New England were used to drinking a water that was kind of tea-colored, a little bit more unctuous. I can't say exactly what those tastes were because those are tastes that have disappeared from essentially the perceptible record. We just have chemical analyses and other things left. So waters used to be even more distinct than they now are, and they are distinct. But when we think of it, a lot of times when I ask people, hey, what does your water taste like? The immediate response may be nothing, or more often than not, they give me a good or bad. It tastes good, it tastes bad, I like it, I don't like it. But beyond that, we are very well equipped at the moment with descriptive language for thinking about our water.
So talking about this like absence of kind of notable flavor, how is it achieved? What additives are being put into the water supply to kind of strip away naturally occurring flavors and aromas? And would this process be called creating an industrial terroir?
So the general processes that have developed over the 20th century are threefold. First process would be essentially once you've screened out any major sorts of large particles that you're going to do a process called coagulation, which is where you're going to add in some chemicals that can help stuff present in the water, excess minerals and other things that they kind of come out of solution, and then you can skim them off the top is a nice way of thinking of it. Then you can filter the water to remove additional sediments, bacteria, etc. And then finally, in most municipal processes, you would chlorinate the water before it goes out into the distribution system. And chlorination not only kills microbes, it also reduces some of the perceptible taste odors that may be present in water. Although, as I noted with the phenol, when phenol and chlorine combine, it can create new smells that people don't like. So the folks who are in charge of water supply are really attentive to that. And you asked me this question about, does it create a form of industrial terroir? And I feel like I should maybe step back and define what that term is. So the concept of terroir is used often when folks talk about wine, and it's been glossed in English as taste of place. And when I'm thinking of an industrial terroir, I'm thinking along two different directions. The first is the idea that industry itself is shaping the tastes of water, for example, that are available. So the forms of pollution or the pollutants that are put into a water supply may themselves cause taste and smell to be present. But then there's a second aspect of it, which is the taste of place as it's been removed or managed by the engineers and scientists and technologists who are working on producing our municipal water.
You cite a blind tasting in the book in which an expert tastes various unmarked mineral waters, but included in the lineup is a bottle of tap water. What was her reaction when she tasted it?
It was disgust. She immediately recognized that this was the tap water. And I'm so curious. I wish I could have been there in the room for that, actually for the preparation, to know if they let the chlorine evaporate out and to better understand what processes were used for that. Many people actually, in tastings that I've done just for fun, and these folks certainly were not the level of expertise of the woman you're referring to in this anecdote, they can't necessarily tell the difference between tap and, say, Evian or tap and Dasani. And so it's really intriguing to me that she had that super visceral reaction.
Yeah, you say that she nearly vomited. You say that some even regular untrained people who are able to spot tap water in the lineup often describe it as tasting dead.
So this specifically refers to one tasting experience that happened at Nestle. I'm going to not necessarily say that all people would say that tap water tastes dead, but I think it's an interesting reflection on the idea that water, and people who've gone hiking and have even just filtered water out of a stream somewhere, know that it's this really varied substance. And this work of making it safe and the work of making it something that works within a municipal water system and the needs of all those pipes and faucets, et cetera, often results in a water that doesn't have some of that, and I'm going to use the word liveliness carefully here, but some of that liveliness or variance that you might otherwise encounter. And I'm going to say, in by and large, that lack of variance is a really amazing thing for how we've set up our lives in the 20th and 21st century. It means you can shower and not be concerned about catching something from the air, the steam you're breathing, or you can flush a toilet and not be concerned that the water droplets aerosolized are potentially going to cause you or your children or your pets harm. But at the same time, perhaps we've lost some of the exposure to helpful microbes that may naturally be present in our waters. There are a lot of unhelpful microbes in our waters too, though.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you how the taste of water varies across different cultures, and if you were able to incorporate any cultural perspectives into your research.
So because my research primarily, at least initially, was following the technology, the development of these technologies for managing taste and smell, I found myself looking primarily at the United States and France, because that's where the collaboration was most strongly going on in the 70s, 80s, 90s, between scientists who were really concerned with, hey, how might we manage the taste of water? But even between those two cultures, while they share in many ways a similar democratic leaning, intellectual foundations, there were really vast differences in what people thought of and continue to think of as good water. The French, by and large, prefer waters with a much higher mineral content than folks in the United States do. They use different descriptors to engage with the same sort of sensory experience. And so I am going to say that, yeah, there are really unique ways of tasting and engaging with municipal water that exist all around the world. And they're shaped by long histories of even what a culture thinks a water should be or should do.
So interesting. So it strikes me that a lot of water pollution these days is flavorless and odorless. I'm thinking about the issue of microplastics and PFAFs. Do you think if these adulterants had flavor that we would see more of a public outcry to get rid of them?
Absolutely. I'm going to give a recent example. Most people are very aware of ongoing issues with water pollution in Flint, Michigan. Fewer people may remember that in 2014, Charleston, West Virginia experienced a very smelly water pollution incident where a local tank leaked a chemical into the water supply that smelled strongly of what many people described as black licorice. And just like that experience in Chicago on the South Side, this was the sort of thing that had local residents calling their municipal water supplier, calling the radio station, calling their governor's office, et cetera. It led to a lot of action. And so if nothing else, once you can perceive it, it certainly leads to actions. And maybe those actions are opting out of, again, of the municipal water supply and purchasing water. In that case in Charleston, West Virginia, they even ended up sending in the National Guard to help make certain people had enough access to drinkable water during that time period while the pollutant was present and then went on downstream. Although, like many other cases of pollution, it of course continued to persist in unexpected and surprising ways.
Yeah, and I suppose given that this issue of microplastics and PFAS exists in products that are marketed to us by not government agencies, mm-hmm. but by companies, we probably won't get the opportunity to be able to assess them by understanding their flavor anytime soon.
Well, and it's just such an interesting question about essentially which molecules do and don't have flavor and how we navigate a world where there are so many that don't and yet are present. And there's certainly flavors that mark the presence of microplastics and PFAS. So for example, many people, when they taste bottled water, if given a check if apply list of different tastings to help them describe it, because for a lot of us, it's pretty hard to actually describe the taste of water. The taste of plastic does come up quite often when someone is engaging with a bottled water. And I think that's in part because we do perceive that taste, which is a marker of those other things, but we haven't yet come to say, oh, that is also the taste of danger.
So fascinating. Thank you so much, Christy.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Christy Spackman is Assistant Professor of Art and Science at Arizona State University and Director of the Sensory Laboratory, an experimental research collective dedicated to disrupting long-standing sensory hierarchies. In a minute, hot butter mushrooms. A brined whole roasted cauliflower. We've got countless ideas of how to make vegetables the star of the plate. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. As a flexitarian who wanted to eat less meat, Pamelia Chia reached for vegetarian cookbooks for inspiration, but she wasn't satisfied with what she found. She didn't want to eat fake meat. She wanted to find inspiration in vegetables. So with Ottolenghi as her North Star, she set out to write a vegetarian cookbook for meat eaters that showcased the flavors she grew up with in Singapore. The result is Plantasia. Pamelia joins us to explain how flavor, accent, technique, and texture all come together to make delicious plant-based recipes.
Yeah, so one of my favorite recipes in the book is hot butter mushrooms. And it's actually a recipe that Chef Guyan from Australia was telling me about. So he has Sri Lankan heritage. And it was basically a riff on hot butter calamari, which is one of Sri Lanka's most famous dishes. And so basically you take mushrooms, you shred them by hand, and then you coat them in this spice and flour mixture. And so it's basically almost like a very, very thin batter, and you deep fry that until it goes all crispy. So that is the technique, right? That is creating that caramelization on the outside, and it's creating texture as well. And he also has the flavor coming in from ketchup manis, which is sweet soy sauce. These things have tons of umami, so they provide the flavor right there. And then he has aromatic accents such as, you know, curry leaves, spring onions. And then finally, you have texture from fresh bits of capsicum and from some cashew nuts. So I feel like these four components are really what make a vegetable dish memorable. Because I think a lot of the time when people who first starting to eat less meat and more vegetables, they tend to neglect texture, or they tend to not remember to help the vegetables with added sources of umami. Because, you know, when you think about it, vegetables on their own, they're mostly water. And so they have very, very little umami on their own. So they really benefit from being cooked with things like soy sauce, miso, gochujang, things like that.
One of the things I love about this book is, instead of you making it a huge travel project through Asia, instead you reached out to an impressive 24 other chefs and authors from a kaleidoscope of countries for their thoughts and their recipes. I would love if you'd share what was involved for you making this decision. I found it so interesting because as you work your way through the book and you meet all of these other cooks, there is something about the recipes that still hold together as a point of view.
Yeah, I think for me, so I grew up in Singapore, and in Singapore, there are so many different races. So I really grew up with this multicultural approach to food, but I felt like it would be a disservice for me to take on so many cultures and cuisines alone. I don't think I can master cuisine so quickly. And so I really wanted to reach out to people who could represent their cuisines and their food cultures well, people who have grown up in Asia and who could tell me, you know, what anyone who wants to eat more vegetables can learn from their part of the world. And so I reached out to them. And I think the beautiful part of what came out of the pandemic was that it showed people that working remotely is a possibility. So I think before the pandemic, I would never have imagined working with so many different chefs remotely. But, you know, it was really amazing getting to talk to them over Zoom, learning so much about their cultures, them sharing recipes with me and me cooking it in my home kitchen. And I think it's taught me a lot about, you know, cooking and about being a good cook, you know, being able to be adaptable and to basically be like a sponge to so many different influences.
What do you think your restaurant background brings to the recipes? I'm thinking about recently, I saw a social media post where a home cook was complaining that he can never get, you know, that gorgeous center of the plate cauliflower recipe to taste like the ones he experiences in restaurants. Could you talk about your center of the plate cauliflower recipe, the podi cauliflower?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think a whole roasted cauliflower is such a showstopper. And I think it's one of the most kind of trendy things in the vegetarian space right now. But funnily enough, every time I ate whole roasted cauliflower in restaurants, I was always very disappointed because it's always very one note and always very bland, because the whole approach is basically you take a whole roasted cauliflower, you coat it in olive oil, salt it well, and then you char it, really char it. But because you're only seasoning the cauliflower from the outside, the inside basically is rather bland. So what I learned was that if you brine the cauliflower, basically treating it like a piece of meat, the center of the cauliflower can take on that seasoning. And then by rubbing it with ghee and that really flavorful podi, which is basically a ground lentil and spice mixture, you get this really nice coating, and it's almost like bark on barbecue pork. And then when you roast that, it's a really nice, well-seasoned vegetable from inside and out.
You make a lot of different types of tofu. I don't know how else to call it. Could you talk about the pigeon pea tofu that you make?
Yeah, so that is, I think, the very first recipe in the book, and it's a Burmese recipe. So it's not a true tofu in the sense that I think a lot of people think of soybean tofu when we mention bean curd or tofu products. But this specific tofu is made using split pea flour. So some people call it chickpea flour, some people call it besan. So it's basically a very fine yellow flour. And when you cook it in water, it thickens and it swells into this porridge. And when you allow that to cool down, it basically becomes almost like a chilled tofu. You can slice it into pieces and it has this springy, smooth texture. So the thing about Asians is that we really love our texture. A lot of ingredients that you would see in Asian dishes are there not just for flavor, but primarily for texture. So, for example, for me, growing up as a Singaporean Chinese, I used to eat a lot of jellyfish salad. And jellyfish on its own has no inherent flavor. It's all about that crunch. And so it's the same in this salad. The split pea tofu basically provides, you know, this QQ quality that we Asians love. And it also has this nice slipperiness, which contrasts really nicely with the crunchy ingredients, such as the cabbage.
Yeah, that first chapter of your book, I wanted to make every single recipe. I often make spicy soy cucumbers, and I really love eating silken tofu with like a sesame kind of dressing. And you created a kind of mashup. Mm-hmm. Describe the sizzling cucumber salad with tofu.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that cucumber dish is a very, very popular Chinese appetizer. Every time you go into a Chinese restaurant, like that would probably be on the menu. And I really like it because it's so easy to love. So basically you smash cucumbers and that allows it to imbibe the seasoning that it's soaked in. And the decision to pair it with tofu actually came from my restaurant experience. So when I was working in Melbourne, one of the chef's favorite ingredients to use would be stracciatella, which is basically the insides of a burrata. And that would be a really nice creamy canvas for something crunchy. And so that dish taught me the importance of texture and, you know, contrasting texture, contrasting creaminess. So you have like the really creamy, silky tofu against the crunchy cucumber. And I think that's part of the reason why that dish is so satisfying to me.
And the peanuts.
Yes, the crunchy peanuts as well. So, I mean, you know, it's something that everyone loves because, you know, not only does it hit every single flavor, you have sour, you have spicy, you have sweet, you have salty, but, you know, from a textural point of view, you know, it's so holistic.
Well, thank you so much, Pamelia. This book is really lovely. There's so many recipes in it I want to try.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks so much for chatting with me and for having me on.
That was Pamelia Chia. Her new book is Plantasia, a vegetarian cookbook through Asia. We've got a recipe for her sizzling cucumber salad with silken tofu on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. You know what I'm going to say now, right? That the pie contest is just a mere 5 weeks away. It's true. KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest and contest will be here before you know it. So mark your calendars for Sunday, April 28th for a fun-filled afternoon on UCLA's Royce Quad. Bakers, we are going big on fruit pie this year and introducing four new categories: double crust apple, apple crumble, berry pie, and a hand pie category. All in, we have 9 categories to choose from this year, including one for kids under 12. So go to kcrw.com/pie and sign up today. On deck, edible flowers, aka how to bring flavor, color, and joy to your next meal. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. I know I keep saying this, but spring is here. No matter where you live, I bet you can feel it in the air. Let's head to Santa Monica to see how spring is showing off this week at the farmers market.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. It is a colorful time of year here at the market. Flowers are everywhere. So it's only fitting that we talk with Rose Wild, owner of Red Bread and the author of the cookbook, Bread and Roses. Hi, Rose.
Hi, Jillian. I'm so excited to be here. It's one of my favorite times.
So in the cookbook, you write that it's time we bring flowers back onto the plate with more intention and abundance. Give us some inspiration so we know how to do just that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, that is my biggest dream. I want to see florals and botanicals take over beyond decoration into flavor. Right now at the market, it's branch season, which means we're getting all the like nectarine and cherry blossoms coming in, which are stunning. But more importantly, it's sort of the end of winter and giving us a lot of what would otherwise be called bolted items. So Coleman Farms, especially right now, has like radishes in flower, arugula in flower, cilantro in flower, sorrel in flower, borage, calendula. Like, it is exploding off the table with colors. And I think one of the things people forget is that everything that grows has a flower, and that thing is going to taste like the item, right? So you can take those arugula blossoms, make yourself an incredible steak, and switch that pepper cream sauce for a cream sauce loaded with arugula blossoms, and you're going to get that pepper punch. That's one of my favorite weeknight dinners. I've also used radish blossoms to freshen up vanilla and milk cakes because it adds this sort of zip to the experience of eating it. So I think that like it's easy to throw it in a salad and really improve it immediately, but you can go across the savory to the sweet kitchen as well. We were just talking about borage earlier, which has this wonderful like herbaceous, juicy cucumber. Someone said oyster flavor. I love it. Like, there's no wrong answers. Like, just put that flower in your mouth, taste it, think about something you love, and apply it.
So you also use some of these blossoms in your pantry staples. Give us some examples of how you do that.
Yeah. So I love to grind lilacs into sugar. Also orange blossom into orange water, roses into rose water. There's a lot of these sort of pantry staples that you can easily do at home with max three steps, and one of them is just time. I also love to press nasturtium into tortillas and like make quesadillas out of them. It's also really fun to take sort of the bloomed sage and herbs and roll them into pie crust or tart dough as a way to like layer again flavor. So I think there's just so many opportunities for blooms to go into otherwise blank spaces and add another tone to it. I also love steeping flowers into cream and turning that into custards, ice creams, and buttercreams, especially a German buttercream. I mean, there's just so many ways to do it. You can also like apply it to salt and then have like a way to add double flavor. So like you can like get a lilac sugar and then like a chamomile salt and use that in the same cake and have this very like bouquet experience. So lots of ways, but I think pantry items are the most accessible and immediate.
Yeah, definitely. So you mentioned pie. So let's just sit with that for a second because we have the pie contest coming up. Would you pair a savory herb crust like that with a sweet pie?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite pies is taking sage blossoms and sage leaves and frying them for about 30 seconds, you know, just until they turn green, pulling them out, letting them crisp up, seasoning them, always season, and then folding that into like a basic pie dough and filling that with caramel apple. Stunning.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. I think that there's so many opportunities. I hope more people who are competing in the pie contest this year put flowers in it. I think that would blow the judges away. I feel like we're giving people the inside scoop right now.
That's right. Straight from the mouth of a judge right here.
I can't wait to see everyone's stuff. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Rose. It's always great to see you.
So good to see you. So good to be here.
That was Rose Wild, owner of Red Bread. She's also a judge at this year's pie contest, and you can find a lot of inspiration and recipes for how to use seasonal flowers in her cookbook, Bread and Roses. One of the farmers with a lot of blossoms on the table right now is Romeo Coleman of Coleman Family Farm up in Carpinteria. And Romeo, just to get us started, maybe go down the table and tell us everything that's blooming right now.
We have a lot of stuff blooming coming in spring. We have arugula, radish, broccoli, summer peony next week. We also have the blue borage, calendula, and the white borage.
I saw some wood sorrel with beautiful yellow flowers there too. Tell everybody what wood sorrel is.
Yes, the wood sorrel, oxalis. It has a nice citrusy flavor to it, really good with raw fish dishes. And it's something that we used to eat running through the hills as a child, the stalks. You chew on those and suck the juice out of makes your face pucker.
Yeah, it kind of makes you gleek a little bit, right? It'll wake you up. So let's just focus on one of these plants and talk about the life cycle and what's going on. Maybe the radish, which are so beautiful. They have these purple and white flowers blooming right now. What's going on botanically to make this happen?
They're coming through into the longer days and they want to push out growth to be a nice healthy plant, and then they go to the next stage, which is flowering, and then the next stage, which will develop into seeds. But we catch them at the flowering stage, and the little flowers make a nice little presentation, have a nice little radish flavor to them.
You know, you don't see these in the grocery store. What made you start bringing them to market?
Well, sometimes you just try new things at market, and quite a few years ago, CJ Jacobson, who had Hero Soul restaurant in the Valley, he went to stage at Noma, and when he came back, he looked me in the eye and told me to bring a bunch of flowers because people are going to start decorating plates and make things look pretty. So it's his fault that I started bringing all these more flowers, and it's developed into a pretty good thing, and they're tasty and beautiful.
They sure are. I mean, people love them. Well, how much longer are we going to have these?
These radish flowers and arugula flowers usually go through the spring till about May. When it starts to get too hot, then they just kind of dissipate.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Romeo.
Thank you.
That was Romeo Coleman of Coleman Family Farms up in Carpinteria. You can find him at the Wednesday and Saturday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Market with a table full of color. For the Market Report, this is Jillian Ferguson.
We have a recipe for Rose Wild's crispy broccoli rabe borage cream cheese from her book Bread and Roses on our website. So get those borage flowers and head to kcrw.com/goodfood for the recipes. You might want to use those borage flowers for a martini too. If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks go out to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Hope Brush, Nick Lamponi, Phil Richards, and Sue Margulies. And a special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. Rose's interview reminded me of a cherry tomato pie I made with chive blossoms in the crust. And speaking of pie, have you signed up to enter this year's contest? The date is Sunday, April 28th, and the URL is kcrw.com/pie. I'll meet you back here next week for another episode of Good Food.